This is episode number 33 with Senior Insights Manager at LinkedIn, Josh Colson.
Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Super Data Science Podcast. Super excited about today's guest. Today we have Josh Colson, who is my friend back from the Deloitte days. So back in 2012 we met and we did some work together, and then he moved on to a new role at LinkedIn, and he's been there ever since, and he's really grown in the team. He's actually now a manager there and has a team of his own and manages a huge part of the Insights team of LinkedIn for Asia Pacific, where he helps employers find the right talent for their organizations and understand how to go about it. So in this podcast, we're going to be heavily focused on how data scientists, aspiring data scientists and analysts, or people who are already data scientists and analysts, can break into the space and find new jobs, find better jobs, find improve their careers, and find opportunities that excite them. Because Josh obviously has all of this access to all this knowledge on how this hiring actually happens. He hires data scientists himself, and he works with lots of companies who are looking for talented people, including data scientists and other professions as well. So you'll get a lot of very valuable information about that, and hopefully that will help you structure your career or structure your approach to breaking into the space. Because as a lot of you guys shared in the survey that we ran recently, a lot of you are actually open to new opportunities, and this was a good chance for to ask the right questions, because Josh has access to a lot of this information. And also, if you are an executive, or if you're a manager, or if you're an entrepreneur, or if you are a business owner, then you'll find a lot of valuable information here on how to actually source the talent, and how the top organizations in the world go about sourcing their talents, and how they leverage LinkedIn data to do that. So can't wait for you guys to check this podcast out. Let's get straight into it. Without further ado, I bring to you Josh Colson, the Senior Insights Manager of LinkedIn in Asia Pacific. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. Today, I've got a very special guest, a good friend of mine, Josh Colson, on the line. Josh works at LinkedIn and he's calling in from Sydney. Josh, welcome. How are you today?
Hi, Kirill. Thanks for having me. I'm fantastic. It is Monday morning here in Sydney. I've already been up and went for a run this morning around the beautiful harbour, so I am ready and raring to go.
Oh, fantastic. So you live somewhere nearby the harbour, or do you run when you get to work?
It's actually funny. I've been, for the last kind of 12 months or so, been trying a bit more to get fit and healthy, as you do when you get a little bit older and have kids. But I've been getting up in the morning and coming into the office, because we live about 10 or 12K out of the city, and then going for a run around the city. It's just probably the most magnificent city to go for a run around in the morning. It's just stunning.
Fantastic. Can imagine. So many people envy you running near the Sydney Opera House. That's so cool. So Josh, we met for the first time at Deloitte back in 2012. Is that right?
2012. Yeah, that's a long time ago. I guess it was 2012, man. I'm trying to rack my brain. Yeah, that sounds about right. I started at Deloitte in 2010. So if you must have started at Deloitte in 2012.
Yeah,
that'd be about right.
Yeah, we had like just 1 month overlap, and I remember I did my very first project for you. And I was like super nervous. Do you remember what it was about? Like some data cleaning or something like that. I was super nervous because it was my first project. And at Deloitte, the managers rate your performance. And I was like, am I going to get like a meet expectation or exceeds expectation? And I think you gave me an EE or SEE or something like that. And I was super excited about it.
I vaguely remember. I'm sure it was back at Deloitte, we were doing a lot of kind of like, audit and financial analytics, and you know, there was a number of projects in there. But yeah, I distinctly remember a young and eager Russian analyst who was pretty damn good at his job.
Yeah, it was a good time. And then all of a sudden, not even a month passes, and Josh heads off to, where did you head off to, Josh?
So I headed off to LinkedIn. It was a really interesting story, actually. It's funny you bring up Deloitte, because that's really was the starting point of so many things. But I remember it was distinctly. I was sitting there on a Tuesday afternoon in the Deloitte office up in Brisbane, with that beautiful view we had over the Story Bridge and the river. And I got an email, what I now call an email, at the time was an email, from a recruiter at LinkedIn down in Sydney, and he mentioned a whole bunch of stuff and whatnot. And to be honest, at first glance, I thought it was spam and completely ignored it for about 24 hours. But I came back to it on the Wednesday afternoon, had a look at it again, and I shot him back a email and said, "Look, this sounds really interesting. Be up for a conversation. You know, whatever. Let me know." I didn't hear back from a couple of days. Little hint to all the recruiters out there, get on those responses. But when he finally did come back, we started a conversation, started a process, and started, a fairly lengthy journey of the recruitment process at LinkedIn. And about 10 or 12 interviews later, a trip to San Francisco, a trip to Sydney for interviews, one of the hardest interview questions I've ever been asked, and they offered me the job, and it was I was blown away. I mean, to be honest, I wasn't really ready to leave Deloitte. I felt like I had so much still to learn. I remember walking into the partner's office to let him know that I had, accepted this new role, and he's like, "Oh, Josh, I still think you've still got so much to go here and so much to give. What's it going to take to get you to Tuesday?" I was like, "Look, mate, this tech has been something that's really interested me for so long. There's really not much you can say." And he accepted that, and that was that. So, I've been at LinkedIn now for a little over 4 years, and absolutely loving it. It is just an amazing place to work. I think the caliber of the people here, the culture of the people, it just makes coming to work every day just incredibly fun.
Fantastic, fantastic. And the partner was Chris Noble, right?
That's right. Yeah, and Chris, as you know, is kind of a tough guy. He's got a very big presence, and I remember that conversation distinctly. And it was not one of the easiest conversations I've ever had. But saying no to Chris is never something that you do lightly. So that was fun.
That's true. And so obviously you've got us all hooked. What was the hardest interview question you were ever asked?
So I remember sitting down with the managing director of APAC at the time, Asia Pacific at the time, in Sydney. And they'd set me up. The head of sales came in and interviewed me, and that was for about three quarters of an hour or so. And it was a fairly congenial, selling LinkedIn kind of thing. And it was I was all bought in. And then this managing director, a great guy, an American called Steve Barron, came in and sat me down and grilled me, just absolutely grilled me for about an hour on my credentials, on my experience. It was a tough interview. And then towards the end of the interview, he asked me this, and he said to me, "Josh, look, I'm a sales guy, so I don't really know anything about, what you're going to be doing at LinkedIn. It's going to be with data. So with data, tell me, why should LinkedIn hire you?" And I kind of looked at him just blankly. I was like, what the hell is he trying to get at here? Ended up, bullshitting my way through it. So it was all good and managed to get the job. So happy ending.
Okay, gotcha. All right, good to know. What data evidence can you give us that why we should hire you? That's a pretty cool question. Yeah. All right, cool. So tell us a bit more about what you do at LinkedIn now. What is your role, and what are your tasks and goals on your day-to-day base?
So when I started in 2012, I was the first person in what we call the insights team. So the insights team at LinkedIn is a is an analytics team that sits within the sales organization, and we're essentially tasked with creating the world's best sales and marketing team using data-driven insights. And the way that we do that is essentially building out tools and narratives and collateral for our salespeople to go out and essentially be the best at what they do and really empower them to be better salespeople. That's on the one hand, and the other part of our role is being client facing. So we'll go out to clients and our largest corporate customers and help them understand their business really in a lens through LinkedIn data. So we're able to apply that LinkedIn data set to some really interesting business challenges. So whether it might be something like entering a new market and understanding what the talent looks like there, or internally, you know, answering questions around, what does my attrition look like? Or, you know, I've had clients come to me and say, look, we know that we've got something like 30% of people who join us leave within 12 months. It's a massive cost to our hiring. I want to know why. I want to know how that compares to our competitors. I want to know in what pockets that's actually happening. Is there anything in the data that you can tell me that may start to address that kind of issue? So that for me has just been incredibly interesting over the last 4 years. But as I said, I started in 2012 as the first person of that team here in Asia Pacific based in Sydney. And I was working with our customers all around the region, which was incredibly challenging. And since then, I've built a team of 13 people who are based here in Sydney, in Singapore, in Tokyo, and Bangalore in India. And just incredibly fun. It's a really gratifying thing to build a team around you and be able to deliver, you know, just so much more impact than what you're able to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yep, gotcha. So you're managing a whole team that's predominantly Asia Pacific, right?
That's it.
That's cool. Okay, so you work with employers and recruiters, as I understand, to help them better assess the market conditions. And actually, I had a look at your talent pool reports on LinkedIn. And anybody listening to this who's an entrepreneur or a business owner, they're very useful. Can you tell us a bit more about them? Back in 2013, I think you did the very first ones for Australia, and that kicked it off here. What are they all about, and how do people use them?
Yeah, actually, the talent pool reports are a really interesting story and it's a really interesting illustration about how we think about innovation, both at LinkedIn at large, but also within our insights team. So when I first started, one of the most common things that we would do is a deep analysis on a particular talent pool, or for the non-HR talent acquisition people, essentially, what does a particular segment of the talent market look like? So, you know, what do Java developers look like in Australia? Who's employing them? Where are they migrating from? Who's educating them? What kind of skills do they have? What kind of experience? All of these kind of things. And then not just looking at the demographical type of stuff, but also looking at some of the drivers and the employee value propositions that drive them to potentially change jobs. So if I'm a up-and-coming Java developer software house, what do I need to do to actually build a team? How do I compete with some of the big guys in Australia? You know, that's the banks employ, you know, just about more technology people than anyone else. You know, Telstra, even up and coming guys like Atlassian. How do I compete with them at a scale where I can attract the best people? And that's what the talent pool reports are all about, trying to help employers understand what the market looks like and how do I employ a really niche set of skills into my organization. So when I started in 2012, these were a very, very manual process. You know, it'd probably take us 2 or 3 hours to, you know, define an audience set, put this into practice, synthesize the data out of our systems, analyze it, visualize it, all that kind of stuff, and then put together a narrative. Over the course of the next 2 years, we automated that process to a large degree where we now have a library of real-time talent pool reports that are incredibly deep analysis, customized to the company that we're talking to. And there's, you know, something like 2 or 3 million different variations that are available in that library. So, you know, we've gone from a manual process right through to a real-time productized version of what we're looking at. And that report, you know, is something that organizations have come to rely on in terms of the talent analytics that's available.
Gotcha. And I was really surprised, or I guess intrigued, to see that you don't only analyze supply, which would be the first thing that you think about when you think of LinkedIn, that there's all these professionals putting up their profiles and you have all this data on how many people you have in a certain region, what their skills are, who's endorsing them, what they're interested in, and so on. But you, in addition to supply, you also analyze demand. So you analyze how recruiters are behaving, what companies are putting out there, what offers, what employment conditions, and so on. Could you comment a bit on that? Like, how do you integrate the two, supply and demand, to come up with these insights?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and like any other market, the economics of the talent economy, if you like, are incredibly interesting and nuanced and dynamic. So, you know, when you're looking at a pool of talent that is fairly commoditized, so, you know, looking at something like accountants, you know, there are a steady supply of accountants, and there's the demand for accountants really hasn't changed over a long period of time. But when you're looking at, especially in the technology sector, but it's not just limited to the technology sector, but I'll get back to that. When you're looking at a niche set of skills that are incredibly in high demand, and that's, you know, in demand from a business point of view, for, you know, these are the kind of skills that are building businesses, that businesses are succeeding because of, the demand on those individuals, really does go through the roof compared to those more commoditized professionals. And what that means is that the price companies need to pay goes through the roof, and the scarcity increases as well. And you know, down the track, that means that more people enter the market and economics takes over and the price eventually comes down. Really, we're able to start to help organizations understand what that demand looks like. And really, that's a bit of a unique thing because of that LinkedIn data set. Not only do we have the job side of things, so we have that job advertisement, and that can be a good proxy for demand, but that doesn't necessarily always get to, that doesn't necessarily marry up the supply with the demand, which really gives you the price sensitivity analysis that you're actually looking for. So we're able to, with that supply and demand data, help organizations understand and set expectations back with the business around how hard it is going to be to find that, you know, Java developer. And if you're looking for a Java developer who's got experience in the education sector, who's got, speaks, you know, Mandarin and was educated at the top universities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it's going to get incredibly hard to find that person. So what we're able to do is use that data and that analysis to set expectations with organizations to look for criteria and a mix of criteria that is actually going to help them hire the best people with the right set of dynamics. So, and what I mean by that is the right cost of hire, so the right kind of salary package, and the right time to hire. So we can set expectations around, look, it may take you, you know, 1 to 2 months to find that person, and depending on how strong your employment brand is, get that person into your organization. So we're able to help companies really understand what that dynamic talent market looks like, especially when there's and it becomes just a whole lot more interesting when it has a look at some of those high demand skill sets. And that's not limited just to tech. You know, you saw a really interesting phenomenon in the Australian economy over the last 5 to 7 years with the kind of the boom and the bust of the mining sector, and that's starting to pick up again now. But you saw truck drivers, you know, earning 200-250k a year in fly-in, fly-out situations, simply because of the lack of supply of talent who was willing to go in and do that kind of thing. Even though I think traditionally the labor economy wouldn't have necessarily seen those skills as high demand and priced them accordingly. And that kind of dynamic is really impacting a lot of industries in a way that we haven't seen before, especially when it comes to digital talent, because digital talent is no longer just a realm of tech companies. You know, every single company wants to become a software company. You know, They all want to build their own in-house capability. They all want to build their own in-house, the stack and whatnot. And what that means is that that ever-shrinking pool of talent becomes ever-increasingly in demand.
Yep, totally agree. And I can attest to that. We're actually at Super Data Science, we're hiring developers right now because we want to bring that capability in-house. And we looked around, and usually you hire people through connections or through your own network or network of people who are already kind of like in the team. But we couldn't find anybody. So the next place we went to was LinkedIn, and we put up a job post. And within a few days, we got some really cool candidates who are now going through the interview process to see if they'll fit. So yeah,
very cool.
So thanks for that.
Pleasure. But and it's really interesting when you can start to look at, so Kirill, I don't know where you were hiring those people, but the other thing we can start to help with is thinking about, like, if I am, for instance, a lot of tech companies are in the San Francisco Bay Area hiring talent, and software developers there can demand just an absolute premium for their services. And like an even more relevant example is data scientists, right? Like data scientists in the Bay Area earn an absolute shitload. Like it's crazy how much they earn, which is awesome. And of course, there's more macroeconomic pressures around cost of living and those kind of things in the Bay Area. But for a company that's starting up, what we can start to help them understand is, if I was to shift my focus away from the Bay Area, I may, and there may be a shift in quality, but can I be looking at different markets to hire data scientists where it may actually be cheaper for me to hire them? Or can we help you make a decision around training up some data analysts to become data scientists internally? And what is the cost implication of that kind of a decision? So that's the kind of analysis that we're really interested in here in the insights team, helping organizations.
Yep, totally. And that's kind of like the WordPress model, like a company that employs over 100 people, completely decentralized, even though they're registered in the Bay Area. They're like, some of them are in Ireland, some of them are in Latin America, some of them are in Asia and so on, like all over the place. And by opening up your mind to where you are looking for people to join your team, you're opening up your company to a global talent pool. And therefore, the costs go down. And if you look well enough and in the right places, you still find quality or even higher quality and diversity of ideas and thoughts in the
Absolutely.
People you're hiring.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other trend that's really impacting that is the gig economy. We're seeing companies now, employ labor that doesn't enter into a traditional relationship with them. They don't have that employment relationship, yet they're able to, build an incredibly strong capability through the gig economy. I think there's risks with that as well. I think you've got risks around your intellectual property and all of those kind of things. But for the right situation, I think that the gig economy is incredibly interesting. And I think it goes well beyond Uber or Airtasker to, things that are, much more interesting. The LinkedIn is actually running a pilot right now in the US with a service called ProFinder, which is kind of flying under the radar but doing incredibly well. And this is all about leveraging the LinkedIn network to really fuel the gig economy. And I'm really excited to see where that goes in the next couple of years as well.
That's very interesting. Could you expand on that a bit? I haven't heard that term before. Gig economy, what is that and what are the implications?
Well, I mean, the gig economy is all about and I think, Kirill, I think you're a great example, right? The work that you did on Udemy and whatnot, you didn't necessarily have a relationship with Udemy before you put the courses on there. You recognized a hole in the market for high quality education, and you were able to go ahead and create amazing content and do that without a formal employment relationship with Udemy. And I think we're saying more and more organizations popping up that are taking advantage of that kind of contracting.
Gotcha. Okay, interesting. So when there isn't a formal employment relationship, but still there's a mutual benefit for collaboration.
Exactly.
All right, cool. Well, that's very interesting. And we talked a bit about the benefits and the different situations for employers. But what advice can you give to our listeners for people who are aspiring data scientists or analysts who are maybe looking for jobs, or maybe they already have a job, but they're open to new opportunities. They want to see what else is out there. What kind of tips or maybe things to look out for can you recommend for them?
Sure. Having built a team over the last few years, I mean, I've done a lot of hiring, and it is really interesting. I find hiring just such a fascinating thing. You know, you make such a huge decision on such a limited amount of information, and so I feel like I've learned a few things in that process. I still don't think I'm the best hiring manager in the world. I'd like to think I'm okay. I think I've got a pretty decent track record. I've got an amazing team that sits around me that makes me look good. look, I think the number one thing when you're looking for a new job, and especially for people who are interested in getting into data science, and I'm really it's been fascinating seeing the number of people, and again, going back to what I was talking about earlier, when a profession or a niche set of skills becomes in higher demand because of technology trends and the like, that we see a lot of new entrants into the market. It's classic economics, right? What that means is that you're seeing new entrants come into the market, into the data analytics and data science fields, who have got an incredible variety of experience, and they're coming from different backgrounds, and they're bringing different lots of experience. So I think the number one thing for me, first of all, for people who are trying to crack into data analytics, it's all about proving yourself. So I am much more likely to take a risk on someone, to hire someone who has shown that they've gone out and have what I'd like to call a growth mindset, and that's the ability to independently learn, show that they are, their learning journey is consistent and constant, and that they're essentially learning the whole time. They're looking for opportunities to learn. They're always looking for feedback. They're looking for ways that they can improve upon themselves. They're not happy with the status quo, et cetera, et cetera. That's something that I really try to hire for, and that's incredibly hard to identify quickly in an interview, right? That's something that is demonstrated over a long period of time. But I think there are things you can do to demonstrate that to people, to hiring managers, especially if you are trying to crack into analytics, and that's going and listening to the famous Kirill on Udemy and taking the best courses that you can and really upskilling beforehand. And I think that one thing that I would like to see more of in the analytics field is more portfolio based work. So the ability for you to whether or not you've built out a successful predictive model or a great data visualization or whatever it is, but look for public ways to actually build up that portfolio of work. I think not enough people in our field do that. And that's something that I would love to see more of, and whether or not that's competing in public data science competitions on things like Kaggle or publishing stuff on on Tableau Public, or Tableau run a whole bunch of different things trying to engage the community, and they do a fantastic job of that. And I'm sure there's plenty of other opportunities out there to build a brand for yourself before you're even starting to engage with employers. And I think there's a huge amount of opportunity to prove that you have that growth mindset. And I think that's probably the number one thing you can do. Prove that you have the ability to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yep, totally agree with that. And I get that question a lot of the time from students saying that, hey, look, I love your courses and so on, but I don't have any experience. Like, what can I do to demonstrate to somebody, to a potential employer, that I have the skills, or even that I'm willing to develop the skills, that I want to gain this? And like, a lot of people get put off by the fact that it seems so hard to break into the field, the space of data science, simply because in their mindset, employers require you to already have some real world hands-on experience before they're going to even consider you. So would you say that that is not the case, that like, even in your position, you would you'd be open to hire somebody who, as you said, has this growth mindset, even though they don't have any real world hands-on experience at a job before applying to your job?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, first of all, for a lot of hiring managers and a lot of businesses out there, well, I mean, I think if you take a step back, I think a lot of businesses still hire purely on experience and still hire pure. I mean, even on like education, like you won't even get through a recruiter unless you've got the right university on your resume or your LinkedIn profile. And look, that's I think that's disappointing. I think that is becoming less and less of a requirement, which is amazing. And I think, you know, the educational model is changing rapidly. I think what we will start to see in our lifetime is university rates continue to decrease as more free-form education becomes and more skill and, especially in the technology fields, skill-based education becoming way more apparent, way more rampant. And that, you know, and the employers will hire based on potential. And, this is something that, I mean, I always, my hiring philosophy is always trying to hire someone better than myself. And that's in, a number of different ways. And that doesn't necessarily need to mean, overall. But looking for something, whether or not that's enthusiasm or energy or, that real kind of doggedness when it comes to learning and the ability to pick something up quickly, and you need to be able to prove that, especially if you're coming from a low base of experience. You need to be able to prove to a hiring manager that risk is worth it, and I think that is something that is possible. I think something that in the analytics field gets overlooked a lot is building a personal brand around that, looking for opportunities to publish content based on what you've done. I think the LinkedIn platform, Medium, other places are just fantastic. I wouldn't necessarily, and this is terrible advice because I don't actually publish enough content. This is something that I've been wanting to do. I need to find some more time to actually do it. But, I think the ability to build a brand, especially if you're looking for new opportunities, is incredibly important. And then there's some great features on LinkedIn.com. You can now show that you're open to opportunities to recruiters, which is not shown on your profile. And you can define exactly what kind of opportunities you're open for and which regions and all that kind of thing, which is really, really interesting and getting a lot of traction. I think it all comes back to lowering that risk for a hiring manager, and if she can see that you are have a big presence in the analytics community and you've contributed in a meaningful way and you've gone about learning and produced some amazing content, I think that is a huge benefit to you.
Yeah, totally. And I'm just going to recap some of those mediums so that people listening to this can either write this down or just have it in the back of their mind. So publish content, get out there. For instance, go do a Kaggle competition, publish a visualization on Tableau Public, then write up an article about what you think about data science or what you're learning and publish it on LinkedIn. Or there's lots of other blogs that are open to publishing. You can submit a blog if you're interested in R programming, submit it to rbloggers.com. Any other ones you can think of, Josh, off the top of your head?
There's so many out there. I think even something that's the more creative professions do a lot better than us in the analytics field is creating their own websites and showcasing their talents and what they've created. And I think that's something that's so cheap and easy to do these days that really is underused.
Yep, exactly. And that's how my most recent job at a superannuation company, that's how I got the recruiter to contact me. I was just posting content on LinkedIn. Like, I actually got this tool called Hootsuite and I scheduled content somewhere. Someone was just like my comments on somebody else's content. And I scheduled it to go out twice a week. And for a few months I was posting and I got more interest. And all of a sudden these recruiters started contacting me. So you can create a passive stream of job opportunities coming your way like that as well. But I wanted to ask you as well, what would you say are the most important skills for data scientists right now? Because like we've heard of lots of things like R, Python, Tableau, Power BI, SQL. Like there's so many different tools and like a whole plethora of them. And for somebody getting into the space, it's really hard to figure out what to focus on. Do you have any tips on that?
Yeah, look, I mean, to be honest, I think the most valuable skills in data science and in data science and in analytics really aren't the technical stuff. It's the it's communication, it's business acumen, it's the ability to translate what you're doing back to impact to the business. And I think there is almost too much of a focus on the technical skill set in data science and not enough on what that's actually meaning back to the business. And I think, you know, you're seeing that in tangible ways where, you know, you're seeing recommendation engines that just recommend what you've purchased prior and not enough intelligence going into like the so what, if you like, to, you know, predictive modeling and what in the analytics field. So I really think that there needs to be more of an emphasis on the business impact and the, you know, customer experience and the end user centricity rather than the actual technical data, you know, technical skills. I think too often data scientists and analytics professionals get way too excited about technical things rather than the impact those technical things actually have on the bottom line. And I think the other one is you know, some of those softer skills around, you know, communication, just being a high quality professional, you know, time management, etc.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. And really appreciate you saying that because a lot of the time I end up in the same situation that I need to explain to people that these soft skills are so important. Like crunching numbers, it's always been a thing. It's always been around. There's so many people that can crunch numbers. But the true data scientists, the ones that can stand out, the ones that are famous, the ones that earn the big salaries, and the ones that are in demand are those that can not just crunch the numbers, but who can actually translate the insights into human language and convey them and help executives take action on those insights. So thank you very much. I appreciate you making that comment.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the really interesting trend for me is in data democratization, and that's the proliferation of analytical skills and data skills into the entire organization. And I think what we're seeing is really that commodification of analytical skills, and you know, they are going to be less and less niche in the future, right? They're going to be more and more mainstream. And you know, you're going to have people in, you know, well, you're already seeing it, right? People in marketing with analytical skills and people in sales, people in all sorts of functions who do their job better because they're data-driven and they have that data-driven mindset and they have that analytical skill set. And I think the data science, I think the hard data sciences will always be a specialized, centralized function. But I think the, you know, some of those other things and what that really means is that, you know, data science practitioners are going to need to become way more closely tied to the business. They're going to need to make sure that what they're doing is producing real and tangible and measurable impact. And they're going to, and I think, you know, and to be honest, that's one of the challenges that we've always faced is measuring our impact. And I think that's something that we need to, as a function, start to challenge.
I agree with that. And I like what you mentioned, that more and more people that, you know, are not specifically in the space of data science will slowly start to need to develop these skills around data. And can you comment a bit more on that? Like, how does somebody that, you know, has never programmed before or has never even considered data as part of their role, like, I don't know, somebody in accounting or HR or I don't know, like maybe somebody who owns a little bakery down the road, somebody who is passionate about what they do, but they haven't ever considered data to be a thing for them. How do they start thinking about data? How do they start using it in their day-to-day decisions and their business or whatever they're doing, their careers?
I think there's a few ways that this is going to happen. For an elite set of companies, you will see an opening up of data skills to the entire organization. I know at Facebook, every single employee has the ability to get access to the SQL databases to start to hack on their own and improve what they're doing through a data-driven way. You know, we have a similar, probably a little bit more restrictive access here at LinkedIn. So I think that's one way of doing it. Like, I think just giving that technical ability and saying that there is, you know, we're not centralizing data skills anymore. I think the other way that that's going to happen is through software platforms and analytical, you know, analytics as a service platforms that are cloud-based, that that makes your mom and pop store incredibly data-driven simply because they invest in that platform, that they can take their transactional data, they can take their customer data and have a customer segmentation model built automatically without the need for a consultant to come in. They can understand their customers in a more granular way and all of those kind of data-driven things that we had considered were incredibly advanced and incredibly necessary of a very highly paid consultant a number of years ago. I don't think that's going to be the case anymore. You know, I think in the future you will see software platforms come in that are incredibly easy to use, that visualization is built in and ease of use is, you know, and I think where we're starting, where I think we've already seen that journey in a couple of places in the organization, and I think that's, you know, really been kicked off in marketing, where, you know, Google Analytics is incredibly easy to use. It is allowing marketing organizations to be incredibly savvy about who they're targeting. You know, you look at even the Facebook targeting and Facebook advertising, and that's allowing marketing people to just be the amount of targeting options in there is just ridiculous, and that's because, you know, that they've done a lot of that work in the first instance to really drive that. And you know, similarly, some of the things you can do here at LinkedIn as a customer are just fascinating. To be a data-driven marketer, and I think you're starting to see that level of data democratization come to other functions in the organization. I think analytics in the HR space is something that's maturing right now in real time and will continue to. I think at the moment it's still at the vanguard of organizations, but you'll start to see that trickle down to every single organization. And you know, I think something like workforce planning for a long time has been a dirty word because no one does it right, and it's kind of been a long joke that, you know, you kind of, it's a finger in the air type of thing, but I think that will become more and more prevalent and more important for organizations to do.
Yeah.
And it will continue to other parts of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's very interesting how this, data, we're capturing more and more data in the world all the time. Like, it's always been there, but now we're just able to capture more of it and therefore apply it in different organizations, like in different areas of the organization all the time. What would you say is like the biggest challenge for organizations dealing with data right now? Like, what is the biggest hurdle or roadblock? Because things are becoming easier, technologies are growing exponentially, but we're still seeing that it takes time for organizations to adopt these technologies and time to start working with data more efficiently. What do you think is preventing them from doing it faster?
Yeah, this is an interesting girl. To be honest, I am incredibly fortunate to be at an organization that data exists in our culture. The very reason LinkedIn is successful as a company and exists as a company because the data our members entrust with us. So we're able to, monetize that because of that trust. LinkedIn's culture starts with members first. And that means that, you know, the members' experience comes first no matter what. But data is at the center of our organization and data is at the center of our culture. I know that, and I have worked in organizations where that is not the case, and data is at the far reaches of the culture. And we were talking about before an organization whose you know, who wouldn't give access to the data to the marketing department.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
and I think that's, you know, that's not an outlier. That's pretty standard. Like I still think that a lot of IT departments see data as their domain, and you will wrestle that out of their cold dead hands. And I think that will change. There will be, you know, I think more and more CEOs and CFOs that are seeing their data is a valuable asset, and you know they want to extract as much data, as much bottom line value out of that asset as possible. So I think there's the, you know, number one, I think a lack of data driven culture. Number two, it's access to data across the organization, and there's probably also, you know, an education factor around a lot of organizations around being data driven. Yeah. So look, I would suggest those two are probably the two biggest reasons why we're the biggest roadblocks.
Yeah, I agree with you. And in that sense, like I'll share a statistic with everybody listening to this, because we ran a survey just recently of all of our listeners, of all our students on Super Data Science, and I'm actually just bringing it up now. Approximately 40%, I think it's 43% of people listening to this podcast. Yeah, 43.3% of people listening to this podcast right now are employed but actively looking for new opportunities, right? So these are people who have a job, who are, you know, excited about what they do, but they're open to new things, and some, and more so, they're actually actively looking for new places to work at. And therefore, maybe, you know, maybe the reason is because there is that little access to data. Maybe it's some other reason. But what I wanted to say is that when you're actually going into an interview, it's not just important to impress the recruiter. It's also, or the hiring manager, or your future manager, it's also important for them to share with you the details of your future role and the structure of the organization for them to impress you, so that you don't end up in a situation where you leave your current job to join a new job where you don't have access to the data and you're not having fun and you're not doing the work that you were thinking you were going to be doing. So, Josh, what would you say is like the most important question or questions for somebody applying for a job to ask in the interview to make sure that they're, you know, setting themselves up for a successful and interesting career?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's I am blown away by the number of people who I get to an end of an interview with, and I say, you know, what would you like to know about LinkedIn? What, you know, what questions do you have for me? They're like, no, I'm good. And I'm like, seriously?
Yeah.
You are, like, as much as I am interviewing you, you are like about to decide upon and embark upon like a massive part of the journey of your career. And yeah, like, I don't know, maybe it's because I come from, you know, I'm now in an organization that I just incredibly enjoy, you know, especially around the data parts of it. I don't think I could go and work somewhere right now that has some of those challenges and enjoy it as much. I mean, absolutely. You know, you've got to decide what's important for you. You've got to decide what you want in your career. You've got to decide what you want in a job. And you know, if data is important to you, and if culture is important to you, you've really got to investigate that and investigate that hard. And make sure that what it looks like on the inside is what you actually want. Because otherwise, you know, that what I was sharing with that organization, the statistic of, you know, 30% of people leaving within the first 12 months, you know, that's largely because the culture, the, you know, what you're doing day to day when you enter the organization is very different from the picture that you had or the assumptions that you made about that organization pre-hire. And, you know, that for me is like is a failure of their employment brand. And you've really got to investigate that. You've really got to try to find out as much as you can. You've got to, you know, find content. There's lots of different ways for you to be able to find content about what it's like to work in an organization. But one of the most crucial is that interview process. I would be spending at least, in my position, it's probably a little bit different for most, 40 to 50% of an interview questioning them, because it's as much about you as it is about them.
Yep, totally. I agree with you. And thanks for sharing that. So I wanted to ask you a couple of quick rapid-fire questions about your experience with data science. Are you ready for this?
Go for it.
All right. So what's the biggest challenge that you've ever had as a data scientist?
Biggest challenge, I'd probably have to go back to Deloitte days.
Deloitte days. Good times.
And so, I mean, the biggest challenge I had for me, I think the biggest challenge I ever have is when a client or a manager says, show me something interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, you start digging into the data and you're like, well, that looks kind of cool. And then, you know, 2 weeks go past and you're like, I'm stuck. And I think anytime you kind of start down a journey without an end goal in mind or without a plan, that for me is just the absolute most challenging. And I hate that. I hate getting into a position where I don't know where the end goal is.
Yep. And I think it's the onus should be on the person asking the question that they ask the right question. Or, you know, at least they ask for your help.
The onus is always on you, right? Like, you can't necessarily control what question they ask. And if they ask a stupid question, like, show me something interesting, I think the onus is on you to really push back on them and say, well, why? What do you actually want to see? What's important to you? What challenges are you facing? You know, if you can't be a good enough consultant or a professional to plan, it's really your own fault if you get into that position.
Yeah. Do you have a specific example of when somebody couldn't identify the business problem and you had to actually sit down and identify the problem first before you could do the analytics?
I'll give you an example where it didn't happen, where I didn't do enough.
Okay, work sounds good.
And again, going back to Deloitte, this is where I was working on a case for an airline, and we got their frequent flyer data, and that kind of narrows it down in Australia, and they really said, you know, show me something interesting. I think the our team had sold it in pretty much like that. So we, you know, and it did. It ended up the engagement went over budget, the engagement went over time, and a large part of that was because, you know, there was a sense of explorative kind of find something fun in the data, and we ended up finding some really interesting stuff. But, you know, without a plan in mind, it's always going to be more expensive, expensive on time and more stressful.
What would you have done differently?
Well, I mean, really, these days I wouldn't have accepted the engagement unless we had a very, very clear plan of exactly what we were going to deliver and what the objectives were. These days my team kind of gets sick of me when we kind of get lost in a conversation and I go kind of, hey, let's take a step back and try to understand what we're actually trying to achieve here and what's the actual objective of what we're doing. I get very frustrated when there's conversations that kind of get lost in the quagmire lost without an objective.
Gotcha. Okay. Continuing the rapid fire questions.
What
is a recent win that you can share with us that you've had in your role, something that you're proud of?
The biggest thing that I'm proud of, at the beginning of 2015, or sorry, the end of 2015, I had a team of four people across Asia Pacific. And then we went on a massive expansion into it 2016 and we went up to a team of 13. So that kind of, was that 3X? 3Xing the team last year, tripling the team last year. It was something that, but tripling the team in a way that we did it, where the team came together and decided what that was going to look like, decided what our strategy and vision and our culture wanted, who we wanted to be, who we wanted to be known as, how we wanted to impact the business. I was incredibly proud of that. It's when you move more into a leadership position, it's less about the technical stuff. But then if we prefer a technical answer, I recently used the Twitter API to pull down some data out of Twitter, which was quite interesting and kind of fun, getting my hands back into the dirt in Python.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Thank you. That's awesome. Double answer to the question. And what is your one most favorite thing about being a data scientist?
My favorite thing about the data, like, I get an incredible sense of achievement when you have like one of those incredible challenges that someone else has, and helping them solve that problem and helping them see that challenge in a new light using data, and helping. My biggest sense of accomplishment is when I can change a decision or change course on something that everybody saw was failing, and using data to change that through data.
Yep. That's awesome. That's definitely can agree with that. That's very inspiring for yourself when you can do those type of things. Next one is it's actually a question from one of our listeners, from Natig Aliyev, and he asked, will there be a need for data scientists in the near future while there are very powerful machine learning tools are being developed? So basically, will data scientists become obsolete?
Look, I don't think data scientists will become obsolete in the near term. Just as the same as software engineers won't become obsolete in the near term, I think we're still going to need very, very intelligent individuals who can tell machines what to do, and whether or not that's in the machine learning space or in the software engineering space. In the longer term, it gets a little bit murkier, and I guess that really depends on your time horizon on that question. I still think the software the current set of software, especially in the machine learning space, still requires so much human intelligence, human configuration and input, and especially on the data cleansing side, right? Like I don't think I've ever been involved in any data science or analytics project where, you know, data cleansing and whatnot is still a massive part of what we do. And I think until that human element is removed, I don't know, I just don't see that becoming an issue in the near term.
Beautiful. Thank you for reassuring. So people from data science keep studying. And from where you sit, from all the things you see about data, you know, you have a team, you work at LinkedIn, you have so much access to data. You actually have this bird's eye view of what's going on in the world. Where do you think the field of data science is going, and what should our listeners prepare for coming in the future?
I think going back to the earlier answer, Kirill, I think it's every organization in the world who has and who sees their data as an important part of the value that they create is going to continue to see that data as more valuable to their bottom line. And I think the real challenge for data science in the near term is connecting with the business and really focusing on measuring their impact, making sure that the models that they're putting in place, the algorithms that they're driving are, you know, driving real revenue or bottom line profit. And that's it, really. I think that's the biggest trend that's happening right now. And I think the data scientists that will be most valued are the ones that are able to build a brand for themselves because they have delivered success to businesses. And I think in the same way that private equity and venture capitalists, you know, provide value by, you know, stripping companies and turning over companies and that kind of thing, I think data scientists will build personal brands based on the work that they can do with organizations to reinforce the top line and bottom line.
Yep, gotcha. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your answers, and thank you for coming on the show and sharing all the insights. How can our listeners contact you or follow you or find you so they can learn more about how your career progresses?
Well, funnily enough, I'm on LinkedIn, so find me on there. And also Twitter. I still very much enjoy conversations that are happening on Twitter, especially in the analytics community.
Thank you. We'll add those links to the show notes. And one final question for you. What is your one favorite book that you can recommend to our listeners to help them become better data scientists?
Now, Kirill, you'll enjoy this. So back when that one month overlap happened in our careers, yep, at Deloitte, you recommended me an author who I looked into and derided at the time for being a bit of a douchebag, Gary Vaynerchuk.
Yes.
And I have rediscovered Gary V in only the last couple of months. And so I apologize for my derision years ago, and to be honest, I wish I hadn't, because maybe I'm in a different headspace. Maybe he's communicating in a different way, but totally connected on a very impressive level, and I've been more motivated and inspired by the work of Gary Vee. And I am currently reading his book, Ask Gary Vee, which is absolutely awesome.
Oh, that's the most recent one, yeah? Book number three or four. That's so cool. I haven't read that one yet, but yeah, totally can attest to that. Gary Vee's got quite a few books. I've read his very first book. The name escapes me right now, but Crush It. There's actually an audiobook on Audible if anybody listens to that. Very, very good book, and very kind of, he's very arrogant, right? Like, you're right. He does come off as a douchebag sometimes, but on the other hand, his methods work, and he's...
I think his energy is just infectious, right? And I think for whatever, like, I'm not an entrepreneur in the traditional sense of the word, and you know, I may be one day, I think for anyone in any part of their career, a lot of the things that Gary talks about, I think, is incredibly valuable, and learning some of those lessons has, you know, even in the last few months, have been incredibly valuable for me.
Have you seen his YouTube show, Ask Gary Vee?
Or the Ask Gary Vee show? I have. Well, the book is kind of a
summary.
Summary or the best bits of that. So I've been watching that, and the daily Gary Vee or whatever it is on his Facebook channel. He's any social media, take your pick. He's there. So highly recommend.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, once again, thank you for coming on the show. It's been a great pleasure to catch up and reminisce about the old days, and also for you to share all these valuable insights. Thank you so much.
Sure.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Lots of valuable insights, and a bit different to our usual conversations about tools and techniques and data science. This time we were focused on careers. We were talking about how you can enhance your career, how you can find better opportunities, and how you can build the career that you deserve, the career that you want for yourself. And personally, my favorite takeaway from today's show was when Josh mentioned how you can get out there, how you can create, how you can become interesting to recruiters, how you can create an agenda for yourself, even if you don't have the data science experience. And plus, even if you do have the data science experience, it's an additional bonus. So remember to get out there, to look at things like Kaggle, at the Tableau public website, building your own blog, submitting articles to LinkedIn, just publishing articles on LinkedIn. You don't even have to submit them, just go ahead and publish one. Or submitting articles to our bloggers and other blogs out there on data science, and tweeting about data science, building this profile, becoming somewhat of an influencer. I can imagine that, you know, it must be hard to become an influencer. Like the level of, I don't know, people like Peter Diamandis or Elon Musk, and very, very top level. But you can become an influencer in your own circle, in people that are interested in things that you're interested in, and then put that on your resume and put that in your LinkedIn profile. Put that in places where recruiters will see that, and it's a big testament to the fact that you are driven. And as Josh said, it's not about just hiring for the skills. It's about recruiters are looking for people who are interested to learn, people who are interested to grow, people who want to enhance their careers, who are hungry for knowledge, who have this insatiable thirst for new things to learn, new things to master, and contribute value to the companies they work for. And we all know that you are one of those people, because you are listening to this podcast. You're likely taking courses on Udemy or on Super Data Science. You're completing the case studies. You're doing everything you can to enhance your career. So you're already, by de facto, that type of person. You just have to show it. You just have to do a little bit of work, do a little bit of hassle to get your passion out there, to illustrate your passion, and then the recruiters are going to start coming to you. The offers are going to start flooding your inbox, and that's what you want. You don't want to be chasing them. You want them to be chasing you. You want to put yourself in that position. So go out there, create content, share information, and create a fame agenda for yourself so that people are interested in who you are and want to know more about you. And on that note, I am super excited that you were able to join us for this podcast. If you enjoy these episodes, then do us a favor, go on iTunes and rate the show, and even if you could leave a review, that would be fantastic. This is quite a new podcast, and any help and assistance we can get in order to spread the word and tell the people out there that this is a pretty cool show to listen to would be very much appreciated. Thank you so much for being here, and I can't wait to see you next time. Until then, happy analyzing.